Blog Talk Radio.
Just a look. Good things go fast and go. Could feel like looking on the bright.
And welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. And that song was sent in by one of my listeners. The band is called Fibercast, and the song is called Paint the Storm. It is very fitting for the topic tonight. I hope everybody had a good spring equinox. Weather here has been really nice, what I call California weather. Highs in the 70s, lows in the 60s, and humidity is real low. It's favorite time of year other than fall for me here. Tonight's topic, the National Socialist War on Christianity, Part 3 and Conclusion. And Part 1 of the Jewish Bankers' War on America. And I just want to let everybody know that I intend to start doing some shows on the American Founding Fathers, along with the founding of the United States and some of its related history. And also some more information regarding communism in America. There will also be some more pre-recorded shows coming up. And I know I've been kind of slouching off on doing shows here lately, but like I've said before, sometimes life gets in the way. So that's just the way it is. For the record, today is March 21st, 2014, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 0 degrees Aries. Now, I have no personal website or blog. Probably wouldn't have a life if I did. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe, be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe, or you can just write me, tell me what you think. I can't guarantee I can respond to all of my emails, but I will read all of them. There will be no calls tonight, which is par for the course. Cat's here next to me. Dog is on the floor, the other side of the room. Now, I just want to mention here, too, that I'm going to be doing some a lot of stuff with computers here the next few weeks with since Microsoft is phasing out its support for Windows XP. Well, I've got to do some things to the computers. And so what I may wind up doing is going ahead and try and upload some of my previous shows from that other network that I used to be on, and just kind of fill in the blanks that way, and then do some, like I said before, plan some more of these pre-recorded shows. We'll see how it goes, but, you know, it might may go smoother than I anticipate. I've got a graphic image that I found here on Facebook, kind of related to some of the topics that, things that I have read in the past about Christianity, and I thought this was one of the better ones, so I thought I would go ahead and read it. It says, I'm going to create man and woman with original sin because a magic rib woman ate an apple because a talking snake convinced her to. Then I'm going to impregnate a woman with myself as her child so that I can be born. Once alive, I will kill myself as a sacrifice to myself to save you from the sin I originally condemned you to. Except that you will still be born in sin for some reason. We're not sure why. I will not give you any evidence of this other than various conflicting tales written down decades after I existed by uneducated desert people. And the tales they will tell will bear striking resemblances to numerous myths from other older cultures. But if you do not believe all of this without question, I will send you to roast in a lake of fire for all of eternity. But I love you. This is true, despite the fact that I know the future, which implies that you are powerless to act in any other way than what I set in motion 6,000 years ago. Ta-da! I thought that was pretty good. So, anyway, the first part of the show, like I said, will be a conclusion of the National Socialist War on Christianity, and we'll wrap up the last two chapters of the book. And after I get through playing a song, we'll proceed on that topic. So I've got a nice little song here, short song I'm going to play. It's called Lucifer's the Light of the World.
Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Lucifer's the light of the world. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Tell me what's that sun. Lucifer's the sun, tell me what's that sun? Lucifer's the sun, Lucifer's the sun of the world. He walked down to the garden, servant said, shall we begin? The God up above wants to do so, then what kind of devil does that make him? Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Lucifer's the light of the world. Sun, Lucifer the sun, tell me what's that sun, Lucifer the sun, tell me what's that sun, Lucifer the sun, Lucifer the sun of the world. Adam's son was a bunny, he said, woman, you made me sin. He said that this God came down from above to protect you, to let the light in. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer the light, tell me what's that light, Lucifer the light, tell me what's that light, Lucifer the light. Lucifer's the light of the world. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Lucifer's the sun of the world. God came down from heaven, said, what have you two done? They said, if that's the kind of God you're gonna be, maybe heaven ain't so much fun. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Tell me what's that light, Lucifer's the light. Lucifer's the light of the world. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Tell me what's that sun, Lucifer's the sun. Lucifer's the sun of the world. Tell me what's that love, Lucifer's love. Tell me what's that love, Lucifer's love. Tell me what's that love.
Okay, all right, this next section of the book is called Christians and Nazi Anti-Semitism. And a brief reminder to everybody, this book is written as and geared towards people who would go to the website like WorldNet Daily, you know, neocon type people, you know, the people who will never ever steer away from Christianity or their support for Israel. Of course, one day they may all of a sudden realize just how screwed over they have become and change their tune, but who knows? I don't see it happening. Not until the big mass shift occurs when everybody realizes that Christianity is a hoax. Then they may catch on then. These people will be like the last people to figure it out, so... Anyway, they use derogatory terms like Nazi, and, you know, their perspective is obviously going to not be the same as ours, so it will be always reflective of the Third Reich and National Socialism in a negative connotation. So, anyway, if you've been following along, you know that already, but just in case I have some people listening in who have not caught the first two parts... So anyway, here we go. Any book that discussed the Nazi war on Christianity would be incomplete if it did not discuss the relationship between Christianity and Nazi anti-Semitism. The unhappy reality of Christian anti-Judaism is historically true. In a book called Sinisterism, Secular Religion of the Lie, I chronicle the interrelationship between Jews and Christians from the earliest days of Christianity. Jewish and anti-Christianism and Christian anti-Judaism both existed, and in neither case was persecution the core of the problem. Jews viewed Christianity as heresy, which would be punished by death. Christians viewed Jews as Christ killers and Judaism as incomplete Christianity. The history of Christian antipathy for Jews needs no elaboration here. Although never anti-Semitic, Christians believe that God, his mother, and all the disciples were Semitic Jews. It has been anti-Judaic and even at different times in history, anti-Jewish. The history of Jewish antipathy for Christians has been just as real and, like just as Christians have on occasion massacred Jews, Jews have also massacred Christians. I'm actually surprised to see that in this book. And it says, sometimes in Yemen in October 523 CE, of course, they're going to say AD, or the Holy Land in July 614. This genocide has resulted in the murder of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of Christians. The methods of murder have also been horrific. During the last two centuries, both Jews and Christians have recognized that their two faiths have in common a unique and good set of values. Huh. This was not meant that pogroms in Russia stopped, but it has meant that nearly the entire Christian world absolutely condemned these crimes as unchristian. This has not meant that all Jews stopped viewing Christianity as a form of heresy, but has meant that many Jewish thinkers have begun to write publicly what many had long thought. Christianity, like Judaism, was a blessing to the world. This became pronounced just as the Nazi threat was growing. Jewish authors like John Cornos, who wrote, "There are two ideas in the world today, communism and fascism, which would make us free, and Judeo-Christianity, which would set us free." And Sholem Ash, who wrote, "The dignity of the human being, that sacred position bestowed on him by the Judeo-Christian religion, can be restored only by acceptance and submission to its teachings." In the 1934 book called The Rise and Destiny of German Jews, Jacob Marcus, "The Clear Distinction Between Christian Socialists and True Anti-Semites," quote, "Christian socialists, as we have seen, wanted to destroy Jewish influence by assimilating the Jews more intimately into the life of the land. The other parties, truly anti-Semitic, wanted to get rid of all German Jews," end quote. The notion that Christianity gave rise to Nazism is wrong, as the notion that Judaism gave rise to that identical twin of Nazism, Bolshevism. Of course, we know better. It is quite true that many of the early Bolsheviks were Jewish. Wow, they admit it. And that many communists around the world were Jewish. They admit it. It is also true that these Jews were anti-Judaic Jews who had contempt for their faith. Okay. As early as 1921, soon after the Bolsheviks came to power, authors were commenting upon this critical fact. Spargo, in his book called The Jew and American Ideal, observes that, quote, "Trotsky has many times declared that he is not Jew, but a general proletarian. And Bela Kuhn, in a formal statement, declared himself opposed to all religions and cultures, the Jewish included. Not only is Bolshevism fundamentally opposed to the Jewish religion, it is equally antagonistic to the principle of nationality itself." Ah! Well, the last part is correct, yeah. He goes on to note that many of the Bolsheviks who were supposed to be Jewish were not, and that many of the people who were Jewish and were listed as Bolsheviks were actually Jewish opponents of Bolshevism. Well, you know, it looks to me here, and I'm interjecting here, of course, you know, these people have finally realized that so much is circulated around the Internet that, you know, the list of the Jews involved in the Bolshevik, you know, I mean, as we all know, were like what, 95% or a little more? And people are finally starting to figure that out. So they got to cover their asses somehow and keep these people, these good Christians, in line. Back to the book. The horror of the Holocaust, a crime perhaps unequaled in human history, has created rage among its victims, which cannot be satisfied merely by the utter destruction of those who actually caused the Holocaust. None of us who have not lived through that nightmare should judge too quickly the sincerity of those actual victims of Nazi mass sadism. But truth, like vengeance, must also have a champion. Not only did Christians not cause the Holocaust, but Christians opposed the Nazi anti-Semitism, which preceded the Holocaust. Well, I tell you, they really give us some lies here in this book, don't they? Let me clear my throat real quick. Haters of Christianity and supporters of Nazis embraced the odious racial theories which led all Jews, whether they embraced Judaism or whether they embraced Christianity, to the death camps. The very issue of race... lost my spot. Page stuck together. The very issue of race, of anti-Semitism, rather than anti-Judaism, turned out to be the first direct conflict between Christians and Nazis regarding Jews. Ooh, they want to make a distinction there. The religion of Jews was not important to the Nazis. Okay, the Jewish race was the enemy. All right. One of the first measures the Nazis sought was to keep Jews who converted to Christianity out of the Christian church. Theologically, this was completely at odds with Christian faith. It was precisely in keeping with the spirit of Nazism and paganism. So Erich Ludendorff, the earliest and most important political figure in Germany to support the Nazis and also one of the most vicious opponents of Christianity, said, quote, "The Jews are not our enemies because of their race, but because one of the their subtlest rabbis, that man called St. Paul, distilled the poison of the Christ myth out of the life of the story of Jesus of Nazareth. The Jews are enemies of the Nordic race because they produce Christianity, which has been the position that has destroyed the vitality of the Aryan people." Close quote. Jews were hated most for bringing into the world Christianity. The rabbi, Paul, had destroyed the vitality of the Aryan people. This was not what Christians have ever thought, and this was manifested quickly in Christian opposition in Germany to any linking of religion and race. But Christian opposition went beyond just opposing the inclusion of Christian Jews into the category of Jews. Schuster notes in his 1935 book that, quote, "After Hitler had been lifted into the saddle, some eminent conservatives tried hard to call off the crusade against the Jews," close quote. And he goes on to observe that hatred of Jews was not endemic in Germany. Quote, "There was no dearth of goodwill toward Jews. It was for several reasons more prevalent among Catholics than Lutherans. The Center Party had good Jewish friends and appreciated them. Various Catholic foundations were befriended by Jews and did not forget to be grateful. A considerable number of intelligent Jews found the road to Rome, and some of them became relatively prominent. Among them were numbered writers, editors, teachers, priests, and civil servants who were eminent in the days of the Republic. All things considered, the tone of the Catholic press was friendly to the Jews. Protestants were quite as courteous and interested," end quote. Something called Christian Counterattack also notes that, quote, "As early as 1933, Cardinal Haber, devoted a series of Advent sermons to condemning Nazi racialism, the new paganism, and the persecution of Jews. And when all others were fearful of helping the Jews because of Nazi threats, the cardinal went to their aid at once, provided a lorry to remove religious objects from the chief rabbi of Bavaria's synagogue and stored them in his palace. The Nazis raised the cry, away from foul Haber, the friend of Jews, and a mob raised his palace, but he was not intimidated. Close quote. Female German pastor Frau Staritz admonished Christians that those Jews who wore the Star of David must be shown special Christian charity under the Nazis. When the one-day boycott of Jewish business took place in 1933, McFarland recites what happened. Pastors and local groups of pastors conferred and sought to exercise restraint. Individual leaders spoke out openly. There is good evidence that the limiting of the official boycott to one day was the result of church intervention. Officials of the World Alliance for Friendship through the churches registered a declaration against the boycott. Dr. Hermann Kepler, at that time president of the German Church Federation, went at once to state officials with his protest against violence, a step that anyone who knew him would take for granted. To what extent such protests were registered or given consideration, it is difficult to say. In July of the same year, the pastors of Berlin made it clear that they would not exclude Jews from the church with the following appeal. The exclusion of the Jewish Christians from our communion of worship would mean the excluding church is exercising a racial law as a prerequisite of Christian communion, but in doing so, it loses Christ himself, who is the goal of even this human, purely temporal law. The Christian church cannot deny to any Christian brother the Christian communion which he seeks. In 1934, the World Baptist Congress deplored and condemned as a violation of the law of God, the Heavenly Father, all racial animosity in every form of oppression or unfair discrimination against the Jews. This body of evangelicals, so often associated with narrow-minded thinking by outsiders, without equivocation, opposed Nazi anti-Semitism. Catholics felt the same. Freely, a Catholic priest wrote in 1940, quote, "With vicious words and more vicious deeds, Nazism boasts of its guilt in seeking to liquidate the Jewish people. Not only is it unchristian to be anti-Semitic, but racism or intolerance of any alien races is definitely against the teachings of Christ." Can we say communism? You hear that, Christians? Soon after the concordat between the Nazi regime and the Catholic Church, Essex and Dark observed, quote, "The church, too, courageously denounced the brutal and organized anti-Semitism." Again, that whatever that publication was, Christian Counterattack notes, quote, "Anti-Semitism denies the Christian view of man," close quote. Christian Counterattack specifically notes the grounds for Christian opposition to anti-Semitism. Yeah, it's in Isaiah. The Jews inserted some footnotes there in their, I can't remember the name of the Bible. But anyway, they hired, there's some famous guy that has got his name on one of these Bibles. I'll think of it and bring it up one day. It's a real popular Bible that's used amongst Protestants, and Jews financed him under his name to insert all these liner notes into the Bible, you know. And you can Schofield, that's his name, Schofield, who, by the way, was a criminal. And of course, you know, hey, who else are the Jews going to hire but a criminal, right? So anyway, these liner notes in there say things like, you know, it is anti-Semitism is sin and all kinds of crap like that. And so that's where it comes from. In today's world, they read this shit. They look at the liner notes and, you know, oh, my God, I'm going to hell if I hate the Jews. Okay, I'll start again at the beginning of that paragraph. Christian Counterattack specifically notes the grounds for Christian opposition to anti-Semitism. It was the assault of the Nazis upon spiritual values that drove the churches to resistance. The point at which conflict was joined varied from country to country. The flouting of elementary principles of justice, interference with the home or with the education of children, the euthanasia program, the anti-Semitic decrees, close quote. Hindenburg wrote in his 1937 book on major European governments that the Pastors' Emergency League, some organization, an organization of some 3,000 pastors under the leadership of Pastor Martin Niemöller, I think I said that right, furnished strong opposition at the outset to the German Christian Church, a Nazi invention, and that the League membership doubled in November 1933 when the Nazis tried to keep Jewish members of the Christian churches segregated from non-Jewish Christians. Now, how would that church be a Nazi invention? That can't be true. Let me clear my throat. So we have propaganda here. I mean, it wouldn't even make sense according to everything I've been reading in this book. So the reaction of Christians when the Nazis tried to exclude Jewish Christians from Christianity was to join in increasing numbers the increasingly dangerous anti-Nazi emergency league. McFarland told what happened early in the reign of Hitler about the Christian clergy's attempt to oppose the racial element in Nazism. A petition was conveyed to the National Synod on behalf of 2,000 pastors, which was not considered, meaning by the Nazis. A group of outstanding theologians on September 23, 1933, issued the following judgment. Number one, according to the New Testament, the Christian church is a church of Jews and Gentiles, visibly united in one communion. Number two, according to the New Testament, only faith and baptism are decisive for incorporation with the church. Jews and Gentiles may equally be brought to faith and baptism. McFarland also wrote that the year 1933 was characterized, as has been indicated, by strong declarations referring to the, by the confessing church, against the dangers of national self-deification, and also by a categorical refusal to subscribe to the Aryan paradigm with which Jewish persecution began. Again, writers at the time were specifically identifying the Christian response to Nazi racialism and noting the unacceptability to Christians of Nazi anti-Semitism. At no point, really, did Christians ever endorse the racial hatred of the Nazis, at least as significantly non-Christian Germans who did embrace racism were not at all perturbed by anti-Semitism. Christians alone were. Power noted in this book that, quote, the Aryan paragraph in this new proposal and the implications of a new creed in which racialism superseded Christian internationalism drew an immediate and sturdy reaction from Protestantism. Dr. Otto Debellius of Brandenburg, who was later to suffer for his termitary, retorted that the gospel must be put before political ideology. This position was not taken without personal risk. See, Christians want to stick their religion in front of government and have you subservient to their whims. Even if they tolerate your presence, their ideas and their so-called morals will be forced on you and society. Back to the book. The Catholic Church in Germany also addressed the Aryan question during the first year of Nazi power, and the Catholic response during the first year of Nazi power was just as emphatic and clear. Quote, we believe that national unity is to be realized not exclusively by identity of blood, but also by identity of outlook, and that the assertion of the single principle of race and blood amongst the members of the same state leads to injustices which outrage the Christian conscience. Close quote. Again, can we say communism? The stand of all Christians against the racial policies of the Nazis were addressed early and clearly. It never changed. But that leaves open the question of how Christians reacted to Jews who embraced Judaism, which is a different question. Those Jews who embraced Christianity were in a particularly dangerous position. Jewish relief agencies who would help unconverted Jews offered no help at all to Jews who converted to Christianity. The Christian response to those Jews in Nazi eyes, but Christians in Christian eyes, meant that if real Christians in Germany did not help them, no one would. But were Christians persecuted themselves silent when Germans persecuted non-Christian Jews? No, and that is a qualified answer. The quiet sympathy for Jews was such that stories swirled around the Christian community. Quote, an anecdote current at the time reveals something of the prevalent spirit. Once, so went the story, an anti-Semitic pastor had prefaced his sermon with the remark, if there be a Jew in this house of God, let him get up and leave. No one got up. Not one word was spoken, but the crucifix above the pulpit detached itself from the wall and slowly disappeared, for the Savior was a Jew. Close quote. Very early in the Nazi reign of terror, the World Alliance for International Friendship through the churches at its meeting in Sofia stated, quote, in a feeling of brotherhood and responsibility with all the churches of the world, while recognizing the right of every nation to safeguard this integrity of its own national life, we are nevertheless deeply concerned by the treatment inflicted upon people of Jewish origin and connection in Germany. We especially deplore the fact that state measures against the Jews in Germany have had such an effect on public opinion in some circles that the Jewish race is considered to be an inferior race. In his 1943 book called It's Your Souls We Want, Stuart Herman describes the fundamental incompatibility between Nazi policies and Christianity. As this book indicated, anti-Semitism was not only one of the irreconcilable differences between Nazis and serious Christians, but the what would be called the Holocaust was too. Quote, incomplete as this itemization of anti-Christian measure may be, it cannot be concluded without mentioning certain Nazi policies which, while not aimed directly at the church, have struck at the accepted social standards of Christendom and are irreconcilable with the Christian ethic. Of these policies, three will automatically occur to the mind of the reader: the official adoption of euthanasia or mercy killing, the glorification of the unmarried mother, and the cold-blooded extermination of the Jews. End quote. That recitation is not qualified by the religion which those Jews practice. It deals with the Holocaust of Judaic and non-Judaic Jews. What caused the churches to be in conflict with Nazi Germany? Christian Counterattack, a 1943 book, explains, quote, it was the assault of the Nazis upon spiritual values that drove the churches to resistance. The point at which conflict was joined varied from country to country. The flouting of elementary principles of justice, interference with the home or with the education of children, the new euthanasia killings, the anti-Semitic degrees, end quote. Again, the reference to Christian opposition to anti-Semitic degrees is not limited to Jewish Christians, but to all Jews who would be collectively the victim of Hitler's odious racial policies. The attacks on Nazi racialism continued even while the Christian church itself was under increasing attack. With its clergy in concentration camps and its possessions seized by the Nazis. At Whitsunday in 1936, in a memorandum addressed from the leaders of the Confessing Church to Hitler, these Christians stated, when blood, race, nationality, and honor are regarded as eternal values, the first commandment obliges the Christian to refuse this valuation. Let me clear my throat again. When the Aryan is glorified, the world of God teaches that all men are sinful. Yeah. If the Christian is forced by the anti-Semitism of the Nazi Weltanschauung, I don't know if I ever say that word right, that's Weltanschauung. If the Christian is forced by the anti-Semitism of the Nazi Weltanschauung to hate Jews, he is, on the contrary, bidden by Christian commandment to love his neighbor. It is hard to see a more direct attack on Nazi anti-Semitism. It is mentioned by name. Former Nazi leaders of Danzig, who left the movement, Hermann Rauschning, wrote, "From an ethical standpoint, there is no Jewish problem. No believing Christian and no humane-minded person can be an anti-Semite. Rosenberg and Ludendorff are right, if in nothing else, in their claim that the New Testament is inseparably connected with the Old, and we Christians with our Jewish heritage." On the first page of the introduction of his book, Rauschning warns that this Third Reich was a Holocaust. Again, Rauschning, without qualification, speaks of the problem with anti-Semitism. He also, in horrible precedence, uses the word Holocaust to describe the Third Reich. Nazi persecution of Jews racketed up in stages. One of the most awful inhumane jumps was in 1938. Support for persecuted Jews continued through the terrible year of Kristallnacht. Quote, 1938 was notable chiefly at the moment of the Czech crisis and for another clear protest by the confessing church against the Jewish pogrom of that year, close quote. During 1938, when Jews were persecuted most viciously, definite groups such as Quakers and Protestants, as well as Catholic societies, were engaged in the very existence relief efforts. Hermann wrote the following about Kristallnacht, quote, "It cropped up again and again at every new and more serious anti-Semitic measure until now the Jews were to be excluded from the German community. Nevertheless, the Confessional Brethren was adamant in its insistence upon protecting these brethren, and I can personally testify that in Berlin, where I personally knew what was going on, the pastors acquitted themselves heroically," close quote. Hamblock in 1939 wrote that it was not mere chance that an anti-Christian movement in Nazi Germany should have happened alongside anti-Jewish persecution, noting that no contortion of Christianity could allow the persecution of Jews that the Nazis were inflicting, and that the Nazis were not even trying to reconcile their actions with Christianity. Ronald Kane, in his 1939 book called Europe, Versailles to Warsaw, wrote that Nazi treatment of the Jews offended serious Christians. In the winter of 1940, when the evicted Jews were first transported from Vienna in trainloads, it was reported that a Jewless Vienna should be Austria's birthday gift to Hitler 2 months later. Shortly thereafter, a number of Christian pastors were arrested because they showed too much interest in the events in Vienna. As late as October 1941, when it was extremely dangerous for anyone to oppose the Nazis, much less to speak up for the Jews, Father Bernard Lichtenberg, dean of the Cathedral of St. Hedwig in Berlin, offered up public prayers in church for the safety of the Jewish people. He made this announcement from the pulpit. An inflammatory pamphlet anonymously attacking the Jews is being disseminated among the houses in Berlin. It declares that any German who, because of allegedly false sentimentality, aids the Jews in any way, is guilty of betraying the people. Do not allow yourself to be misled by this unchristian attitude, but act accordingly to the strict commandment of Jesus Christ. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Communism. Father Lichtenberg was arrested on October 23rd, 1941, for the crimes of having prayed for the Jews and having offered prayers for Jews. When Monsignor Lichtenberg was arrested, he offered to be transferred to the Lodz, L-O-D-Z, ghetto. Although Lichtenberg, beloved by his flock, was only sentenced to 2 years in prison. On October 23, 1943, he died as he was being transported in protective custody in a cattle car on the way to Dachau. When Stuart Hermann left Germany after war broke out between Germany and America, he relates, quote, "One of the last visitors I had before leaving Berlin a year ago was a German pastor who had joined in the confessional struggle with gusto and carried a tremendous burden of work and responsibility for many years. Yet when he heard of the recent wholesale massacre of Jews in Poland and in Russia, he said, "I can't stand it any longer. No matter how the war ends or when it ends, I'm going to leave for America. My wife and I talked it over the other night. I'm not young anymore, but I can never be happy here in my own country." End quote. Father Otto Mueller helped Jews escape the Holocaust, and as a result, he was arrested and tortured to death at Berlin Tegel prison in 1944. An estimated 5,000 Catholic priests and monks were arrested by the Nazis for the opposition to Nazism and were sent to concentration camps during the Second World War. More than 2,000 of those Catholics died in the camps. Both Sigmund Freud and Albert Einstein, famous Jews who had previously had nothing but contempt for Christianity, publicly applauded the church for standing up to the Nazi for its defense of the Jews and noting that no one else in Germany or occupied Europe was standing up to the Nazis. Christians who themselves were facing a Holocaust and who were placed themselves in smaller and more hopeless ghettos of Nazi society were also the only people in Germany who were opposing the Nazi mistreatment and murder of Jews. Did Christians fail to save Jews? Christians failed to keep their own pastors out of concentration camps. Nazis hated Christians and would not listen to them. At a time when Gandhi was urging the Jews of Europe to commit collective suicide, Gandhi actually was for something. That was great. I really kind of have a negative view of him. Maybe I shouldn't. Anyway, let's see here. Where was I at? Well, at a time when Gandhi was urging the Jews of Europe to commit collective suicide, at a time when Muslims were applauding the extermination of the Jews, at a time when the Bolsheviks, even after the Nazis began to war against them, ignored the Holocaust, Christians publicly denounced the evil of anti-Semitism and condemned the Nazi policies toward Jews. The Holocaust and Nazi anti-Semitism was not the consequence of too much Christianity, but of too little Christianity. Final chapter, and this one is like just real short. It's just like a couple of pages here. And then I'll give the name of the book and the author and where to find it. This last section is called Nazi Ideology and German Christianity. What we call the ideological spectrum is simply the invention of those who hate Judeo-Christianity and all that this moral and philosophical tradition represents. There is no right in politics which, if pursued too far, leads to Nazism. The Nazis, the Bolsheviks, the fascists, and all the other isms which finds Jews, Christians, Judaism, and Christianity indigestible all believe in the same godless, power-mad systems of violence and dishonesty. I have written an entire book called Sinisterium, Secular Religion of the Lie, which details exactly how historically the Nazis have been Bolsheviks who have been fascists. Okay. This was noted by writers during the 1930s when discussing Nazism. Now, there were some former communists who became Nazis. Yeah, they figured it out and saw where they went wrong. So, yes, that's true. Let's see here. This was noted by writers during the 1930s when discussing Nazism. The odious German Christian movement and the German faith movement, those anti-Christian and anti-Semitic varieties of Nazi religion, are enemies of Judeo-Christianity, which I simply call Sinisterist, Sinisterist, because that allows us to have a world that includes all the totalitarians, wherever they may have been placed on some mythical ideological spectrum. Those today who hate Christian Jews, America and Israel, worship the same pagan pantheon. They are all sibling sinisterists. It is impossible to build the Gulag on Torah. It is impossible to build the Treblinka on the cross. The Judeo-Christian tradition is the only protection we have in life against these horrors. but those who hate Christians and Jews do not wish Christians to be seen as separate from Nazis, just as they do not wish Jews to be seen as separate from Bolsheviks. And so the far right has come to be synonymous with devout Christians. Oh, well, that is part of my agenda to fix that. In this reasoning, if this reasoning was wrong, then you would expect to find Christians and Nazis mortal enemies. This is, of course, exactly what happened historically. Christians alone proved unconquerable by the Nazis. It can be said that Christians, no, the Germans were fighting a war. Okay, it can be said that Christians did not succeed in stopping Hitler, but it can be said, cannot be said, that they did not try, often a great loss, and nearly always as true martyrs, people who could have chosen to live, but who chose to die for the sake of goodness. Film, television, and other elements of media and culture completely ignore this. How often in films involving the Nazis do we see Christian clergy rounded up by the Gestapo? That's because the films are by Jews. Or how many times have we seen Hollywood showing Christian masses protesting against the Nazis after the Nazis were in power? And how many times have movies shown Nazi leaders mocking Christianity? The Nazi war on Christianity and the Christian response to Nazis is a politically inconvenient fact, just as presumed Christian collaboration with Nazis is a very politically convenient myth. Today, look at how any efforts to maintain symbols of Christianity in schools is crushed. Look at how school books are purged of religious portions. Look at how celebrities take pot shots at Christianity, growing increasingly outrageous as they see that nothing happens for their slanders against Christianity. Compare what happened in Nazi Germany with what is happening now. What was happening in Weimar Germany and then in Nazi Germany is happening today in America. This book does not pretend to cover all the different interactions and opinions of hundreds of millions of people during the decades it covers. Rather, I've pointed to the uniform opinion of those authors who wrote about the Nazis and Christianity at the time when Nazis were in power. Christianity, Judaism, and Judeo-Christianity, a term coined by Jewish writers in the 1930s, were viewed as the mortal enemies of Nazism, just as these were viewed as the mortal enemies of Bolshevism. The Judeo-Christian moral and theological tradition was as incomplete with Nazism as it was with Bolshevism, both of which were simply manifestations of human evil. Just as the Bolsheviks, so often accused of being a Jewish conspiracy, gleefully closed down synagogues, suppressed the teaching of Hebrews, and persecuted Jews, so the Nazis, so often accused of being sort offbeat variety of Christians, gleefully denounced Christianity, sent pastors and priests to concentration camps, and persecuted true Christians. In a world dominated by simmering and often boiling hatred for Judeo-Christianity, it is increasingly important for all the elements of Judeo-Christianity to unite, and these elements of Judeo-Christianity must unite under the common banner of truth. That is the simple purpose of this book. Okay, end. And there's a complete bibliography. It is completely footnoted. This book is called The Swastika Against the Cross, The Nazi War on Christianity. And it is subtitled The Hidden History of How the Nazis Persecuted Christians and How Christians Defied the Nazis. Again, it's called The Swastika Against the Cross, The Nazi War on Christianity. The author's name is Bruce Walker. You can find it at Amazon. You can probably get it at Barnes & Noble, etc., etc. Now, who is Bruce Walker? Bruce Walker is a columnist whose articles have appeared in WorldNet Daily, Front Page, The Washington Times, and many other online periodicals. His first book, Sinisterism, Secular Religion of the Lie, has been ranked among the most essential books of our time. Yeah, right. Okay. So anyway, this is a good book to have around to show people, even though it is propaganda, that they certainly persecuted Christianity. Now, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to play another song and come back, and we're going to go over the Allied intelligence regarding this topic. And so let me get a song going here, and I'll be right back.
You listen.
Okay, I'm back. And let's see here. This is originally a form of an email, and I'm just going to basically pretty much just read it as it was presented to the audience intended. It says, the Third Reich leadership worked to remove Christianity from the nation, and as we will see, had long-term plans to not just remove Christianity, but replace it with their original religion. This article will show this fact. It came to light in documents the Rutgers Journal, that's Rutgers University, published that the National Socialist leadership did indeed have a long-term plan to remove the Christian program from Germany. And this is from the Office of Strategic Services Research and Analysis Branch. And again, this was published by the Rutgers Journal. And this is called RNA number 3114.4, the Nazi Master Plan, Annex 4, the Persecution of Christian Churches. Description. It says, this study describes with illustrative factual evidence Nazi purposes, policies, and methods of persecuting the Christian churches in Germany and occupied Europe. Draft for the war crimes staff. And it's got some links in here, and I tried going to these links, and they're not good anymore. But at one time, they were. And, you know how it is. Stuff disappears from the net. I'm sure with enough pressure, they will... probably had it removed on purpose to hide this fact. It says, contents. The Rutgers Journal of Law and Religion, produced by Rutgers University law students, has begun posting documents from the Nuremberg Project, a collection of trial transcripts, memoranda, and reports from the Nuremberg war crimes trials preserved by William J. Donovan, assistant to the American chief prosecutor at the International Military Tribunal and housed at the Cornell University Law Library. The documents have been scanned from TypeScript and are to be posted every 6 months with additional scholarly commentary published on a rolling basis. The first installment is a July 1945 report by the Office of Strategic Services, that's known as the OSS, that was the Allied Intelligence Organization. It was called The Nazi Master Plan, The Persecution of the Christian Churches, with commentary by two British scholars on the persecution of religion as a war crime. The report describes government interference in churches in Germany and countries under Nazi control, intimidation and banning of certain denominations, and arrest and murders of clergy. Links to other relevant websites are planned for the future. Quote, the fragile typewritten documents from the 1940s lay out the Nazi plan in grim detail, close quote, writes Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Edward Collymore. Quote, take over the churches from within using party sympathizers, discredit, jail, or kill Christian leaders, and re-indoctrinate the congregants. Give them a new faith in Germany's Third Reich, close quote. Hitler made certain the church was well under his thumb and in support of his dogmas. One group of Nazi ideologues who had infiltrated German churches went by the mundane moniker called German Christians, almost as if they were holding themselves aloft as the standard by which fellow Germans should judge true Christianity. Okay, well, I'm going to interject here. There's your explanation in the book right there. Okay, back to the article. There were no such thing recommended as they did scrapping the entire Old Testament and including the insidious Aryan paragraph. The ideologues prevailed, and the churches voted into their confessions the paragraph which barred from the pastorate any Jewish converts or those married to Jews. The misnamed German church, German Christians, argued in radical disagreement with the scriptures that Jews could not be saved. Their goal, in short, was to undermine the scriptures and doctrinal standards in favor of Nazi propaganda. The party line was to become the 28th book of the New Testament, the Gospel according to Adolf. Quote, a lot of people will say, I did not realize that they were trying to convert Christians to a Nazi philosophy, observed Julie Seltzer-Mandel, editor of the Nuremberg Project for the Rutgers Journal of Law and Religion. They were looking to eliminate Christianity. Quote again, important leaders of the National Socialist Party would have liked to meet this situation, meaning church influence, by complete extirpation of Christianity and the substitution of a purely racial religion, said one of the documents highlighted by the Nuremberg Project, a July 1945 report by the OSS, who was the wartime intelligence predecessor of the CIA. The report further points to the systematic nature of the persecution as the best evidence now available as to the existence of an anti-church plan. The report goes on to say, different steps in that persecution, such as the campaign for the suppression of denominational and youth organizations, the campaign against denominational schools, the defamation campaign against the clergy, started on the same day in the whole area of the right and were supported by the entire regimented press, by Nazi Party meetings, by traveling party speakers. And by the way, this is all footnoted as well. Quotes from the U.S. government documents, 1946-47. The attention of the tribunal is next invited to document 840-PS, previously introduced into evidence as Exhibit USA-355. The tribunal will recall that this was a Bormann decree of the 14th of July, 1939, referring with approval to an earlier Bormann decree of the 9th of February, 1937, in which the defendant Bormann ruled that in the future all party members who entered the clergy or who undertook the study of theology were to be expelled from the party. I next offer in evidence document 107-PS, which is Exhibit USA-351. This is a circular directive of the defendant Bormann dated 17th of June, 1938, addressed to all Reichsleiter and Gauleiter, top leaders of the leadership corps of the Nazi Party, transmitting a copy of directions related to the non-participation of the Reich labor services in religious celebrations. The Reich labor service, the tribunal will recall, compulsorily incorporated all Germans within its organization. And it cites that as Jackson et al., 1946. Number one, important leaders of the National Socialist Party would have killed complete extirpation of Christianity and the substitution of a purely racial religion. And that's OSS report cited in BBC 2002. Number two, the fragile typewritten documents from the 1940s lay out the Nazi plan in grim detail. Take over the churches from within, using party sympathizers, discredit, jail, or kill Christian leaders, and re-indoctrinate the congregants. Give them a new faith in Germany's Third Reich. Cited Columbar 2002, and it gives a link where the original OSS report was at one time available. The political reality of dealing with the Catholic Church and how Hitler worked to dismantle its powers within Germany. Joachim Fest wrote that at first the church was quite hostile and its bishops energetically denounced the false doctrines of the Nazis. Its opposition weakened considerably in the following years after the Concordat. Cardinal Bertram developed an ineffectual protest system, or resistance, remained largely a matter of individual conscience. In general, they, referring to both churches, attempted merely to assert their own rights and only rarely issued pastoral letters or declarations indicating any fundamental objection to Nazi ideology. The deal, referred to as the Concordat, Hitler signed with the Catholic Church, while on the surface was an uneasy alliance. The greater effect was it a purposely designed contract that officially declawed the power of the Roman Catholic Church in the political life of the new German system. On April 8th, Hitler sent his vice chancellor, Franz von Papen, P-A-P-E-N, a Catholic nobleman, founder of Kreuz and Adler, which is Cross and Eagle, an association of wealthy Catholics established to forge links between Catholicism and Nazism, and former member of the Center Party, to Rome to offer negotiations about a Reichskonkordat, a nationwide concordat, on behalf of Cardinal Pacelli, Ludwig Koss, the outgoing chairman of the Center Party, negotiated the draft of the terms with Papen. Throughout the years of the Weimar Republic, the National Socialists had always been a staunch opponent of such an agreement, but now Hitler intended to deal a decisive blow against political Catholicism and at the same time gain international recognition of his fledging regime. The Center Party's chairman, Koss, had arrived in Rome shortly before Papen. Because of his expertise in church-state relations, he was authorized by Cardinal Pacelli to negotiate terms with Papen, but pressure by the German government forced him to withdraw from visibly participating in the negotiations. The bishop saw a draft of the Reich Concordat on May 30, 1933, when they assembled for a joint meeting of the Fulda Bishops Conference, led by Brussels Cardinal Bertram, and the Bavarian Bishops Conference, whose president was Munich's Michael von Faulhaber, Bishop Wilhelm Berning of Osnabrück, and Archbishop Conrad Grover of Freiburg, both admirers of Hitler, presented the document to the bishops. The strongest critics of the Concordat were Cologne's Cardinal Karl Schulte and Eichstätt's Bishop Conrad von Preysing, who pointed out that since the Enabling Act had established a dictatorship, the church lacked legal recourse if Hitler decided to disregard the Concordat. Notwithstanding, the bishops approved the draft and delegated Grover, a friend of Cardinal Pacelli, and Monsignor Koss to present the episcopacy's concern to Pacelli and Koss. On June 30th, the bishops issued a statement drafted by Grover that announced their support for the Concordat. Let me clear my throat. Though the Vatican tried to hold back the exclusion of Catholic church, clergy, and organizations from politics, it accepted the restrictions to the religious and charitable field, which effectively meant acquiescing to end the Center Party. During the Concordat negotiations, Cardinal Pacelli had acquiesced in the party's dissolution, but he was nonetheless dismayed that it occurred before the negotiations had been concluded. The day after, government issued a law banning the foundation of new political parties, thus turning the NSDAP into the party of the German state. One of Hitler's key conditions for agreeing to the Concordat in violation to earlier promises had been the dissolution of the Center Party, which occurred on July 5th. On 14th of July, 1933, Hitler accepted the Concordat, which was signed a week later. Shortly before the signing, Reichskonkordat on the 20th of July. Germany signed similar agreements with the major Protestant churches in Germany. The Concordat was finally signed by Pacelli for the Vatican and von Papen for Germany on the 20th of July. The Reichskonkordat was ratified on September 10th, 1933. Article 16 required bishops to make an oath of loyalty to the state. Article 31 acknowledged that while the church would continue to sponsor charitable organizations, it would not support political organizations or social and political causes. Article 31 was supposed to be supplemented by a list of protected Catholic agencies, but this list was never agreed upon. Article 32 excluded clergy and the members of religious orders from political and social activities. The next section is called The Growing Divide. On January 24, 1934, Hitler appointed Alvin Rosenberg as the state's official philosopher. Church officials were perturbed. The indication was that Hitler was officially espousing the anti-Jewish, anti-Christian, and neo-pagan ideas presented in Rosenberg's myth of the 20th century. Pius XI and Cardinal Pacelli directed the Holy Office to replace Rosenberg's myth of the 20th century on the Index of Forbidden Books on February 7, 1934. Cologne's Cardinal Schulte met with Hitler and protested at Rosenberg's role in the government. Ignored by Hitler, Schulte decided that the church needed to respond and appointed the Reverend Joseph Tusch, T-E-U-S-C-H, to direct the defense against the Nazi anti-Christian propaganda. Tusch eventually produced 20 booklets against Nazism. Catechism Truths alone sold 7 million copies. Later in 1934, Studium Zum Mythos des 20th, a pamphlet of essays attacking Rosenberg's myth of the 20th century was released in Bishop Clemens von Galen's name. Studien was a defense of the church. In 1937, Orsenigo was invited along with the diplomatic corps to a reception for Hitler's birthday. Orsenigo again asked the Vatican if he should attend. Pacelli's reply was, "The Holy Father thinks not. Also, because of the position of this embassy, the Holy Father believes it is preferable in the present situation if Your Excellency abstains from taking part in manifestations of homage toward the Lord Chancellor." During Hitler's visit to Rome in 1938, Pius XI and Pacelli avoided meeting with him by leaving Rome a month early for the papal summer residence of Castel Gandolfo. The Vatican was closed, and the priests and religious brothers and sisters left in Rome were told not to participate in festivities and celebrations surrounding Hitler's visit. On the Feast of the Holy Cross, Pius XI said from Castel Gandolfo, "It saddens me to think that today in Rome, the cross that is worshipped is not the cross of our Savior." The Catholic Church attempted to undermine the National Socialist government. The Catholic Church officially condemned the Nazi theory of racism in Germany in 1937 with the encyclical Mit Brennender Sorge, signed by Pope Pius XI, smuggled into Germany to avoid prior censorship and read from the pulpits of all German Catholic churches. It condemned Nazi ideology as insane and arrogant. It denounced the Nazi myth of blood and soil, decried neo-paganism of Nazism, its war of annihilation against the church, and even described the Führer himself as a mad prophet possessed of repulsive arrogance. So what do you think about that, Christians? Okay. Although there is some difference of opinion as to the impact of the document, it is generally recognized as the first official document to criticize Nazism. Hitler stated in response that, "I shall open such a campaign against them," referring to the Catholic Church clergy, "in press, radio, and cinema, so they won't know what hit them. Let us have no martyrs among the Catholic priests. It is more practical to show they are criminals." End quote. Again, Christians, what do you think about that? This is the OSS. Okay, the encyclical to the Nazis. This encyclical to the Nazis was a call to battle against the Reich, and that Hitler was furious and vowed revenge against the church. The Nazis were infuriated and in retaliation closed and sealed all the presses that had printed it and took numerous vindictive measures against the church, including staging a long series of immorality trials of the Catholic clergy. Sounds appropriate to me. The true extent of the Nazi fury at this encyclical was shown by the immediate measures taken in Germany to counter further propagation of the document. Not a word of it was printed in newspapers, and the following day the secret police visited the diocesan offices and confiscated every copy they could lay their hands on. All the presses which had printed it were closed and sealed. The bishop's diocesan magazines, called Amtsblätter, were proscribed, and paper for church pamphlets or secretarial work was severely restricted. A host of other measures, such as diminishing the state grants to theology students and needy priests, which was agreed in the Concordat, were introduced. As part of this, 170 Franciscans were arrested in Koblenz and tried for corrupting youth in a secret trial, with numerous allegations of priestly debauchery appearing in the Nazi-controlled press, while a film produced for the Hitler Youth showed men dressed as priests dancing in a brothel. On July 25th, 5 days after the ratification of the Concordat, the German government promulgated a sterilization law which particularly offended the Catholic Church. 5 days later, the first steps were taken to dissolve the Catholic Youth League. During the next years, thousands of Catholic priests, nuns, and lay leaders were arrested, many of them on charges of immorality or smuggling foreign currency. Historian Heinz Hurten, professor emeritus at the Catholic University of Eichstätt, noted that the Nazi Party had plans for the Roman Catholic Church, according to which the Church was supposed to eat from the hands of the government. The sequence of these plans, he states, followed this sequence: an abolition of the priestly celibacy and a nationalization of all church property, the dissolution of monastic orders and religious congregations, and the influence of the Catholic Church upon education. Hutzen states that Hitler proposed to reduce vocations to the priesthood by forbidding seminaries from receiving applicants before their 25th birthdays, and thus had hoped that these men would marry beforehand during the time in which they were obliged to work in military or labor service, which, it's got here 18.25 years. I guess that means when they move it, go into the service at that age or something. I don't know. It says also, along with this process, the Church of Sacraments would be revised and changed to so-called Lebensfeiern, Lebensfeiern, the non-Christian celebrations of different periods of life. Program points of the newly created National Reich Church, headed by Rosenberg. The National Reich Church of Germany categorically claims the exclusive right and the exclusive power to control all churches within its borders of the Reich. It declares these to be national churches of the German Reich. The national church is determined to exterminate irrevocably the strange and foreign Christian faith imported into Germany in the ill-omened year 800. That time period should ring a bell to my my regular listeners. The national church has no scribes, pastors, chaplains, or priests, but National Reich orators are to speak in them. The national church demands immediate cessation of the publishing and dissemination of the Bible in Germany. On the altars, there must be nothing but Mein Kampf. To the German nation, therefore to God, the most sacred book, and to the left of the altar, a sword. On the day of its foundation, the Christian cross must be removed from all churches, cathedrals, and chapels, and it must be superseded by the only unconquerable symbol, the swastika. These points attack Christianity, and one can observe the new Reich Church was a program designed to slowly phase out Christianity, even banning the publishing and dissemination of the Bible in Germany, while bringing people into pure national socialism. Under the leadership of Rosenberg, Bormann, and Hitler, who were backed by Hitler, the Nazi regime intended eventually to destroy Christianity in Germany, if it could, and substitute the old paganism of the early tribal Germanic gods and the new paganism of the Nazi extremists. As Bormann, one of the men closest to Hitler, said publicly in 1941, "National Socialism and Christianity are irreconcilable." And I will repeat that. As Bormann, one of the men closest to Hitler, said publicly in 1941, "National Socialism and Christianity are irreconcilable." Let me clear my throat. Any influence that would impair or damage the leadership of the people exercised by the Führer with the aid of the NSDAP has to be eliminated. To an ever-increasing degree, the people must be wrested from churches and their agents, the pastors. Only the Reich leadership, together with the party and the organs and associations connected with it, has a right to lead the people. The political reality of the next section is called the political reality of the time in Germany. Because of the long history of Christianity in Germany, Hitler could not attack Christianity as openly as he did Judaism, communism, or other political opponents. The list of Nazi affronts to and attacks on the Catholic Church is long. The attacks tend not to be overt, but were still dangerous. Believers were made to feel that they were not good Germans, and their leaders were painted as treasonous and contemptible. The state removed crucifixes from the walls of Catholic classrooms and replaced it with a photo of the Führer. Next section is changes to national holidays, Yule, time in the Third Reich. The Christmas tree was also changed. The traditional names of the tree, Christbaum or Weihnachtsbaum, was renamed in the press as fir tree, light tree, or Yule tree. The star at the top of the tree was sometimes replaced with a swastika, a Germanic sun wheel, or sig rune. Christmas carols were changed. The words to Silent Night were changed so it made no reference to God, Christ, and religion. Words were also changed to the hymn, Unto Us a Time Has Come, so as to remove references to Jesus. Nazi ideologists claimed that the Christian elements of the holiday had been superimposed upon ancient Germanic traditions. They argued that Christmas Eve originally had nothing to do with the birth of Jesus Christ, but instead celebrated winter solstice and the rebirth of the sun, and the swastika was an ancient symbol of the sun, and that Santa Claus was a Christian reinvention of the Germanic god Odin. Accordingly, holiday posters were made to depict Odin as the Christmas or solstice man, riding a white charger, sporting a thick gray beard, and wearing a slouch hat, carrying a sack full of gifts. The Hitler Youth of the Future of German Society is the next section. This is from the diary of the German Minister of Justice, 1935, page 174. Prosecuting authorities in Waltershut, Baden, criminal proceedings against the Catholic vicar, or vicar, however you pronounce it, Paul Wassmer. It is submitted with the request that it be discussed whether a penal sentence should be proposed by Rosenberg because of libel. In a sermon, the accused cited the last verse of a song which is being sung by young people and against which Bishop Behrs has taken exception in his official paper dated 10-35. The text is as follows. Pope and Rabbi shall yield, and we want to be pagans again. No longer creep into the churches. The orb of the sun alone is leading us out with the Jews and with the people from the German home. In addition, the accused quoted from page 8 of Blut und Eier, the little book of songs published by Balder von Serac, a verse with the following text. We want to complain to the Lord in heaven. K-Y-R-I-E-L-E-I-S. Kyrielles? We want to complain to the Lord in heaven, however you pronounce that, that we want to kill the priest. And that word again. Out with your spear, forward. Set the red cock on the cloister roof. Meaning set the cloister roof on fire. Furthermore, the accused quoted a saying of Balder von Serac's, the path of German youth is Rosenberg. From page 192, number 4, the Archbishop of Paderborn reported on the 6th of June regarding incidents on the 12th of May with a request that steps be taken to see that similar things did not occur again in the future. On the 12th of May, the Archbishop of Paderborn was to hold a confirmation. On the 10th of May, a Hitler Youth Führer conference took place, at which a secret order was issued, according to which the Hitler Youth were to attend at specified places in HAMM, H-A-M-M, in uniform clothing, not service dress. On Sunday, the 12th of May, the Hitler Youth appeared in uniform clothing at the big parade ground. There, the song about the foreign exchange racketeer was practiced. And the word for that is Devisen Schleiberleid. Devisen Schleiberleid. On page 637, when we were foreign exchange racketeers, there were the three of us, a father and two monks. They were foreign exchange racketeers. There was a nun with them. And when they continued racketeering, then there were only two. One was in jail. They nabbed him. Then the fun was over. Then she whispered softly, "Now it is your turn, my friend. Now you come with our close-cropped hair, looking like an ass with ears to answer the heavenly roll call." I presume that's ass. It's A, period, period, period. I don't know. Van Fuhrer Grotet then made a speech. Scattered over the railway station in the square in front, according to the plan, on the appearance of the Archbishop, a civilian gave three cheers for the beloved Lord Bishop. When the Archbishop wanted to get into his car, the Hitler Youth tried to prevent him. Calls of down with the foreign exchange racketeer, and so on. Hitler Youth rush after the car and try to overturn it. A few youths jump onto the running board of the car, and when they are prevented from doing so, push their way forward, brandishing their daggers of honor. A Hitler Youth tries to spit into the car. Passersby who urge them to stop are abused and beaten. A woman civilian has to be carried away from the square. When the Archbishop arrives at the church, the Hitler Youth roar, "Throw the black fellow down the stairs." During the sermon, the Hitler Youth continue the uproar, often banging against the church door so that the service is greatly disturbed. Finally, the emergency squad restored order. On that day alone, there were seven Hitler Youth leaders from outside present in Hamm, H-A-M-M. They were in civilian clothes. Number 9, the prosecuting authority, Bamberg, reports regarding criminal proceedings against Chaplain Heinrich Mueller and the town clergyman. Franz Rumor concerning an offense against the law of 2012-34. The accused have stated in a circle of Catholic church clergy that the following song was sung by the Hitler Youth at the party rally in 1934. Let me scroll a little bit here. It says, "We are the happy Hitler Youth. We need no Christian virtues, for our Fuhrer Adolf Hitler is always our mediator. No parson, no evil man can prevent us from feeling ourselves to be Hitler children. We do not follow Christ, but horse vessel, away with incense and holy vessel, water vessels. We follow our flag singing as worthy sons of our ancestors. I am no Christian, no Catholic. I go with the SA through thick and thin. I can do without the church. The swastika is redemption on earth. I will." And then it's got in parentheses here, "log its steps, Wouter von Surach, take me with you." It doesn't have an end. It doesn't have a closed parenthesis, so I don't know how that's supposed to read exactly. Anyway, it goes on. Or the article does. Hitler's references to Providence and God and the ritualistic pageantry of Nazism were more than likely pagan than Christian. Earthly symbols of German valor and Teutonic strength were to be worshipped, not the forgiving, compassionate representative of an Eastern Mediterranean servant ethic imposed on credulous ancient Germans by force and subterfuge. The phrase is Burleigh's own in Michael Burleigh, The Third Reich, A New History, Pan, 2001. A Hitler Youth marching song, Grunberger, A Social History, illustrates it. It says, "We follow not Christ, but horse vessel, away with incense and holy water. The church can hang for all we care. The swastika brings salvation on earth." Then it says, "Horse vessel was an early Nazi party Sturmabteilung, street fighter murdered by communists and turned into a martyr by propaganda chief Joseph Goebbels." The next section is the SS nucleus of the New Germany. The SS were particularly anti-Christian, and officers and men were encouraged to leave the church, although those that refused to renounce their Christian faith were not visibly punished, perhaps because their otherwise faithful adherence to SS codes of behavior gave the lie to any claims of true Christian affiliation. The SS also brought in its own neo-pagan rituals for marriage, ceremonies, and baptisms. Starting in 1939, the word Christmas was forbidden to appear on any official SS document. And the summer solstice was formally celebrated. These ceremonies were celebrated the old way, with sacred fires and torch-lit processions. Weddings and baptisms were replaced by pagan SS rituals, and gradually the entire Christian liturgical rubric was in the process of being replaced by a completely pagan version. Even the Hitler Youth were not immune. A so-called Nazi primer published during the war contains many examples of pagan ideology and anti-Christian sentiment designed for its youthful readership. Himmler's dream was to create out of the SS a new religion based on the pagan elements of what he perceived to be the original Ur-Aryan, and that's Ur-Aryan, religion of the ancient India and Europe. However, many Germans were devout Christians. Hitler himself realized this and knew that he had to play politics with them for as long as the churches held power and as long as the people felt they owed spiritual allegiance to the churches and what they represented. In this, he was cynical in his dealings with the church as he was pragmatic with the capitalists. Unbeknownst to many, daily meditation was the requirement of the SS. I'm going to repeat that. Unbeknownst to many, daily meditation was the requirement of the SS. Himmler set up a school of occultism in Berlin branch, and many of the leading ranks of the Totenkopf SS, the Sichersteindienst, Sichersteindienst, and the Gestapo, were ordered to attend courses in meditation, transcendentalism, and magic. It was in this establishment that Himmler was persuaded to found the Annonerbe, the Nazi occult bureau. The Annonerbe incorporated the membership of Crowley's spurious Templar order, the Vril, and the Thule-Gesellschaft into the Black Order of the SS. Now I'm going to mention something here. I'm going to interject something before I forget. I just want to mention it. You know, many know that they sent expeditions to Tibet, and one of these expeditions brought back the whole, I think it was 106 or 108 volume set of something called the Kangsur, K-A-N-G-U-S-U-R, and at least publicly, no one knows what happened to that. I may get into that in more detail at some point. That would be an interesting topic to do, is discuss the expeditions to Tibet. I mean, you know, there's some, you know, at least a little bit in part of a show, maybe. We'll see. Okay, back to the article. Several books published by the Nazi Party, including Gestaltung der Feste im Jahres, und Lebenslauf in der SS family. In other words, the celebrations in the life of the SS family by Fritz Weitzel, as well as the SS Tante Friede, illustrate how the National Socialists regarded traditional Germanic heathenry as primitive superstition which needed reworking to better serve the state. Celebrated the traditional festivals like Yule and Summer Sonnenwend were encouraged and recast into veneration of the Nazi state and Führer. Clear my throat. The SS Center of Wevelsberg is the next section. In 1934, Himmler leased the castle of Wevelsberg in Westphalia for 100 years and immediately began repair work on this relic and its transformation, including construction of a tower of initiation. The entire small village was evacuated, and most of its ancient houses with runes carved in the wood were included within the enclave. The residents were compensated and moved to Buren, even the pastor. Thus, this castle would come to the Reichsführer der SS auf der Wevelsberg, the school for the preparation of SS leaders in Wevelsberg. The castle was declared a national monument and maintained as such. a Bergwart, an acting chief of the SS, would permanently live in the castle and direct the Reichsfuhrerschule. Why did they select Westphalia? That is where Hermann the Cherusker, or Cheruskos, Arminius to the Romans, defeated the legions of Quintilius Varus in the Battle of Teutoburg Forest. And above all, there were the ancient megalithic constructions of the Externstein are found. The Irminsul, which Charlemagne destroyed, and the Grove of Sacred Oaks were located there. We wish to speak about this North Tower because Clus, C-L-U-S, have been symbolized and expressed there, keys to initiation and secret of the SS. The rest of the castle was for the daily lives of the students of that sacred school, with its library of 40,000 volumes selected from among the Hitlerist Weltanschauung, with dining halls and dormitories with objects of traditional ceramics and engraved with runes, especially the Sieg rune, the Hegel rune, and the Lefort's swastika. Since the looting and destruction of the war, this invaluable library has disappeared. Where did its volumes and documents end up? We know the SS destroyed the most important archives and set fire to the tower under construction. We entered the North Tower of Initiation. First, we went down to the underground enclosure, where we waited for another comrade coming from Hamburg. Their wives accompanied them. This is a round vaulted space with almost musical acoustics, because it transformed any sound coming from the exterior into music. 12 low stone pillars, like diamonds, followed the circle of the wall. Among them, there must be unknown emblems and symbols. I'm sorry. They put a period in here where it shouldn't be. Among them, there must be unknown emblems and symbols. On them, a dozen SS initiates would lean back and recline. On the roof of the vault, the leftward swastika appears carved in stone, combined with the Sieg rune, the SS emblem. In the center of the floor of this underground vault is another circle, an empty space where something should be, or rather where they lit the fire. We went to the second floor of the tower, finding ourselves in another circular hall with 12 pillars connected by arches and with 12 windows beyond each column. The floor was marble with the design of a leftward swastika in the center combined with a Sieg rune. It is well-known fact Himmler led many SS torchlight processions to the Externstein site. This site was one of the most holy places in the pagan world. It should be obvious by now, the leadership and thus minds behind the Third Reich were anti-Christian and working to bring Germany back to the oak and out of the sickly pew. End. Okay, I'm going to go back to the studio here, and I'm going to play another song, and we'll come back and begin the next part of the show. And I'm going to try and go as long as I can into the next hour. So if anyone's listening live, you want to call in before the end of hour two if you want to catch it live. Otherwise, you will have to download. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play the song, and I'll be right back.
A house of makers, Loretta singing on the radio. Smell of coffee, eggs and bacon, car wheels on a gravel road. Pull the curtains back and look outside. Somebody somewhere don't know. Come on now, child, we're gonna go for a ride, car wheels on a gravel road. Car wheels on a gravel road. Car wheels. got folks in Jackson. We're going to meet Coil on a gravel road. Cotton fields stretching miles and miles. Hank's voice on the radio. Telephone poles, trees and wires fly on by. Coil on a gravel road.
Topic. I guess many of you are beginning to wonder if I was ever going to finish that up. All right. Now we can move on. So hopefully everyone has gotten the message on the facts regarding the Third Reich and Christianity. This next section is called The Jewish Bankster's War on America. And this is in two parts, and I don't know how long it's going to take me to get through each one of these, okay? But if for some reason I don't get through even this end of the first part, we'll pick it up on the next show that I do, which will probably be this topic, unless, of course, it's one of my Texas shows. Okay. The establishment of a central bank is 90% of communizing a nation. Now that is Vladimir Lenin saying that. Okay, this next quote is Mayor Amschel Rothschild from 1790. Let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not for who writes its laws. And the next one is a quote from New York Times Professor Wilhelm, a German historian born July 8, 1937, says, the Rothschilds introduced the rule of money into European politics. The Rothschilds were the servants of money who undertook the reconstruction of the world as an image of money and its functions. Money and the employment of wealth have become the law of European life. We no longer have nations, but economic provinces. Okay, the next quote here is someone named Stuart Crane, who says here is an economist. Says, if you look back at every war in Europe during the 19th century, you will see that they always ended with the establishment of a balance of power. With every reshuffling, there was a balance of power and a new grouping around the House of Rothschild in England, France, or Austria. They grouped nations so that if any king got out of line, a war would break out, and the war would be decided by which way the financing went. Researching the debt positions of the warring nations will usually indicate who was to be punished. Let me scroll a little bit more. This the way this is out, it's like a real narrow stream of text, okay? And so I'm going to have to scroll a lot to read this, and there will be some pauses for that. And I may have to scroll down a little bit to see what it, see where, like in this instance, the citation of the quote here. Okay, this is the sources, Maxims of George Washington by A.A. Appleton and Company. It says, they, referring to the Jews, work more effectively against us than the enemy's armies. They are 100 times more dangerous to our liberties and the great cause which we are engaged in. It is much to be lamented that each state long ago has not hunted them down as pests to society and the greatest enemies we have to the happiness of America. Let's see here what this next one is. This really is going to be kind of hard to read, but I'll get through it. Well, I'm just going to read. That's the easiest thing for me to do. I fully agree with General Washington that we must protect this young nation from an insidious influence and penetration. That menace, gentlemen, is the Jews. In whatever country Jews have settled in any great number, they have lowered its moral tone, depreciated its commercial integrity, have segregated themselves, and have not been assimilated, but have built up a state within a state. And when opposed to have tried to strangle that country to death financially, as in the case of Spain and Portugal. Hope I said that right. Have segregated themselves and have not been assimilated, have built up a state within a state, and when opposed have tried to strangle that country to death financially, as in the case of Spain and Portugal. For over 1,700 years, the Jews have been bewailing their sad fate and that they have been exiled from their homeland, as they call Palestine. But, gentlemen, did the world give it to them in fee simple? They would at once find some reason for not returning. Why? Because they are vampires, and vampires do not live on vampires. They cannot live only amongst themselves. They must subsist on other people not of their race. If you do not exclude them from these United States in the Constitution, in less than 200 years, they will have swarmed here in such great numbers that they will dominate and devour the land and change our form of government for which we Americans have shed our blood, given our lives, our substance, and jeopardized our liberty. If you do not exclude them in less than 200 years, our descendants will be working in the fields to furnish them substance, while they will be in the counting houses rubbing their hands. I warn you, gentlemen, if you do not exclude the Jews for all time, your children will curse you in your graves. And that was all by Ben Franklin at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 in Philadelphia. Now, there's a note here right below that. It says, note, Jews have been howling these quotes as false forever because they know they are not false and been, in fact, true, and thus a great damning condemnation of their crimes. Let me light a cigarette here. It says, when on the Day of Atonement you walk into a synagogue, the very first prayer that you recite, you stand, and it's the only prayer for which you stand, and you repeat three times a short prayer, the Kol Nidre. In the prayer, you enter into an agreement with God Almighty that any oath, vow, or pledge that you may make during the next 12 months, any oath, vow, or pledge that you may take during the next 12 months shall be null and void. The oath shall not be an oath. The vow shall not be a vow. The pledge shall not be a pledge. They shall have no force and effect, and so forth and so on. Hang on. Wouldn't like there. And further than that, the Talmud teaches, don't forget, whenever you take an oath, vow, and pledge, remember the Kol Nidre prayer that you recited on the Day of Atonement, and that exempts you from fulfilling that. And that came from Friedman. Does this sound like a people who you can trust to tell you the truth? I believe that's probably Benjamin Freeman. Okay, the silent war against America started in 1791 when the Rothschild agent and Jew, Alexander Hamilton, and George Washington's cabinet. Now, let me say something here before I go any further, and I don't know if it's going to be brought up here or not. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about Alexander Hamilton in a future show. I will say this. Hamilton is not a Jewish name. It is a Scottish name. His father was Scottish. His mother was obviously a Jew. And he left her, and she remarried and married a Jew. And Alexander was raised Jewish. And I'll leave it at that for right now. He was in Washington's cabinet, obviously, and we'll go into more detail about some of this stuff if this article does not cover it. Let me clear my throat. Okay, the silent war against America started in 1791 when the Rothschild agent and Jew, Alexander Hamilton, and George Washington's cabinet was able to set up the legal base for a central bank in America to be born, the first bank of the United States. With a 20-year charter in 1811, the charter of Rothschild's first bank of the United States runs out, and Congress votes against its renewal. In response to this, Nathan Mayer Rothschild threatens the American government with a direct statement. Either the application for renewal of the charter is granted, or the United States will find itself involved in a most disastrous war. The American government refused to bow to the threat, and the vote remained. Nathan Rothschild, upon hearing the news, makes the statement, "Teach those impudent Americans a lesson. Bring them back to colonial status." So Britain, by this time, being firmly under the control of the Rothschilds and other Jewish banker families, declares war on America. The War of 1812 begins, which will last several years and kill thousands and leaves the American capital burned to the ground. The aim of this war was to cause the free Gentile nation of America to create such a massive war debt in defending themselves, they would be forced to cede and renew the charter. The plan succeeds in 1816. The American government, forced by terrorist tactics of the Jews, creates a new 20-year charter for the Rothschild's Second Bank of America. Cigarette went out. Let me relight it. In 1832, things start to change. Andrew Jackson runs for the second campaign for office on the promise, Jackson and no bank. Jackson, angry at the criminal nature of the Rothschild's banking tactics, desires to end their mafia-like control on America's money system and put it back into the trust of the American people. Jackson does this by removing all government deposits from the Second Bank of America and into the Gentile-owned American banks. The Rothschilds then send their agents out to contract the money supply to cause a depression in the nation to hit as a way to pressure the government. Jackson openly declares then as the crooks they are and vows to rout them out. Not long after, on January 30th, 1835, there is an assassination attempt on President Jackson. He is saved by the fact the assassin's pistols both misfire. Later, Jackson states he knew the Rothschilds were responsible for the attempt. Jackson, not intimidated by Jewish banking mafia, continues his long fight against the Rothschilds Bank. In 1836, he wins and has their bank cast out of the nation when their charter is not renewed. Says, "I am one of those who do not believe the national debt is a national blessing. It is calculated to raise around the administration a moneyed aristocracy, danger to the liberties of the country." And that was Andrew Jackson, letter to L.H. Coleman of Warrenton, North Carolina, dated the 29th of April, 1824. And I would also suggest that if you have not done so already, go listen to my show where I played someone reading his farewell speech when he left office, because he discusses money, banking, and corporations and their control, etc., etc., etc. It is very informative. Later in 1841, President Tyler vetoes the act to renew the charter for the Rothschilds Bank. In response, he is threatened with assassination from many anonymous sources. The Jews manifest the Civil War in America. And let me say something here. I've got some other interesting stuff about some of this history on the some of the things that occurred right before the beginning of the war that I'll get to at some show somewhere down the line. And some of it may come out in pieces over time. We'll see. It kind of depends, you know. I have to shift gears so many times that it's hard to say. Okay, the Jews manifest the war in America. President Lincoln appeals to large New York-based banks for loans for the war. Rothschild and the Jewish banker mafia are behind many and have influence over these banks. The criminal deal they make him is 24 to 36% on all monies loaned, another attempt to regain control over American people by debt. Lincoln, angry and not stupid, simply prints his own debt-free money instead outwitting the Jews. Lincoln states of this fact, "We gave the people of this republic the greatest blessing they ever had, their own paper money to pay their own debts." In 1863, Lincoln discovers the Tsar of Russia, Alexander II, is having identical problems with the Jewish banks, mainly the Rothschilds, and was also resisting their attempt to create a central bank in Russia. The Tsar then comes to the aid of Lincoln by ordering that if England and or France, both under the domination of the Rothschild Jewish banker families, actively came to the aid of the South, he would consider this an act of open war and take up arms on the side of Lincoln. The Tsar then orders a major part of his fleet, Pacific fleet, to San Francisco and to New York harbors. And again, this will be discussed in more detail at a later time. In 1865, President Lincoln states, "I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in the front of me and the financial institutions in the rear. One of the two, the one in the rear, is my greatest foe." In the same year, on the April 14th, Lincoln is assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. Now, this article says that Booth is a Jew. I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm just going to read this article, okay? John Booth, a Jewish silversmith whose ancestors have been exiled from Portugal, well, I guess he is, because of their radical political views. In London, their refugees had continued their trade in free thinking, and John had married Wilkes's cousin. The Wilkes's was the celebrated agitator John Wilkes of Westminster, London. John Wilkes Booth's father was Junius Brutus Booth, in parentheses, the Mad Booths of Maryland. Now, just FYI, I read this a long time ago. I can't remember everything I read. I wish I could. But anyway, Major General Count Sharep Sporadovich shows just how it was the Jewish bankers created the Civil War, why they opposed Lincoln. To pay the soldiers, the government issued at its treasury notes, authorized by an act of Congress on July 17, 1861, for $50 million bearing no interest. These notes circulated at par with gold. The Rothschilds' agents inspired the American banks to offer to Lincoln a loan of $150 million, but before they had taken much of the loan, the banks broke down and suspended specie payments in December of 1861. They wished to blackmail Lincoln and demanded the shaving of government paper to the extent of 33%. An extortion which was refused. A bill drafted for the government issued of $150 million, which should be full legal tender for every debt in the United States, passed the House of Representatives February 25, 1862, and was hailed with delight by the entire country. But the Wall Street bankers were furious. Senator Pettigrew reprints the so-called Hazard Circular sent in 1862 by the Bank of Rothschilds. I'm sorry, Bank of England, ruled by the Rothschilds. Slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power and chattel slavery destroyed. This, I, referring to Rothschild, and my European friends, 300 men, are glad of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of the laborer, while the European, read Rothschildian, plan led on by England, i.e. Rothschilds, is for capital to control labor by controlling wages. This can be done by controlling the money. The great debt that capitalists will see to is made out of the war must be used as a means to control the volume of money. To accomplish this, the bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now waiting for the Secretary of Treasury to make his recommendation to Congress. It would not do to allow the greenback, as it is called, to circulate as money any length of time, as we cannot control that. Thus, the order of the Rothschilds was clear. Capitalists will see to it that a debt is made out of the war. The result was that by hook and crook, the Rothschilds enslaved this country, and Schiff's, Baruch's, and Company are the rulers. The chairman of the Committee on Ways and Means of the House of Representatives, Mr. Thaddeus Stevens, explains how the United States was captured by the Rothschilds. The agents of the banks fell upon the bill in haste and disfigured it. In the Senate, this amendment was tacked upon the bill. Good for all debts and dues of the U.S. except duties on imports and interest on the public debt. And in parentheses it says $150 million above mentioned plus $70 million of pre-war debt, close parentheses. Thus equipped, this bill went forth to rob every American and turn the ownership of this nation into the hands of capitalists. Let me clear my throat. When the bill came back to the House, Mr. Stevens said, "We are about to consummate a cunningly devised scheme which will bring great loss to all classes of people except one, the Rothschilds branch of Wall Street." The bill was passed. The Rothschilds were in possession of 80% of the gold of the country. They had a corner on gold. By securing discrimination against greenbacks by means of the exception clauses, they made a market for their gold. Importers were obliged to go to Wall Street to buy gold to pay duties on their goods, and the Wall Street gamblers held the power to fix the price. Gold went to a premium. Had the greenbacks been permitted to retain their full legal tender quality, there would have been no need for gold to pay import duties. The price of gold rapidly rose, and before the war closed, had reached the price of $2.85 measured in greenbacks. The gold bought in Wall Street to pay import duties became the revenues of the government and was by it paid back to Wall Street as interest on the public debt. As fast as the bankers sold the gold, it was returned for interest on the public debt to be sold again. Thus, during the entire war, these gold gamblers speculated in gold, making fortunes from the blood and tears of the American people. Mrs. M. E. Hobart, in her The Secrets of the Rothschilds, page 54. Okay, two more issues of $150 million each with the except clause were authorized in July 1862 and in March 1863. It's a typo here. Making in all $450 million, they bore no interest. When these issues were exhausted and necessity arose for additional money, the bankers demanded that Treasury notes should no longer be made in the form of dollars, but in the form of bonds. Bond draws interest, the dollar does not. A gigantic war costing $7 billion was carried through without gold. Why? Because everything was supplied at home, and the American money, the greenbacks, were gladly accepted. How then was it that this government, several years after the war was over, found itself owing in London and Wall Street several hundred million dollars to men who never fought a battle, who never made a uniform, never furnished a pound of bread, men who never did an honest day's, meaning work, in all their lives? The fact is that billions owned by the sweat, tears, and blood of American laborers have been poured into the coffers of these men for absolutely nothing. This sacred war debt was only a gigantic fraud concocted by European capitalists and enacted into American law by the aid of American congressmen who were paid hirelings of their ignorant dupes. That this crime has remained uncovered is due to the power of prejudice, which seldom permits the victim to see clearly or reason correctly. The money power prolongs its reign by working on the prejudices. That's Lincoln. Every means has been employed to deceive the masses. Ridicule and derision have been applied to all opposition, while flattery and appreciation were showered upon the officials. And this is all written by Mary Helbar, page 49. Bismarck in Germany knew the truth and revealed it in 1876 to a German, Conrad Siem, who published it in La Vielle France, V-I-E-I-L-L-E, N-216, March 1921. Bismarck said, "The division of the United States into two federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial power of Europe. These bankers were afraid that the United States, if they remained in one block and as one nation, would attain economical and financial independence, which would upset their financial domination over the world. The voice of the Rothschilds predominated. They foresaw tremendous booty if they could substitute two feeble democracies indebted to the Jewish financiers to the vigorous republic, confident and self-providing. Therefore, they started their emissaries in order to exploit the question of slavery and thus to dig an abyss between the two parts of the republic. Lincoln never suspected these underground machinations. He was anti-slaverist, and he was elected as such, but his character prevented him from being the man of one party. When he had affairs in his hands, he perceived that these sinister financiers of Europe, the Rothschilds, wished to make him the executor of their designs. They made the rupture between the North and the South imminent. The masters of finance in Europe made this rupture definitive in order to exploit it to the utmost. Lincoln's personality surprised them. His candidature did not trouble them. They thought to easily dupe the candidate woodcutter. But Lincoln read their plots and soon understood that the South was not the worst foe, but the Jew financiers. He did not confide his apprehensions. He watched the gestures of the hidden hand. He did not wish to expose publicly the questions which would disconnect the ignorant masses. He decided to eliminate the international bankers by establishing a system of loans, allowing the states to borrow directly from the people without intermediary. He did not study financial questions, but his robust good sense revealed to him that the source of any wealth resides in the work and economy of the nation. He opposed emissions through the international financiers. He obtained from Congress the right to borrow from the people by selling it to the bonds of the states. The local banks were only too glad to help such a system, and the government and the nation escaped the plots of the foreign financiers. They understood at once that the United States would escape their grip. The death of Lincoln was resolved upon. Nothing is easier than to find a fanatic to strike. The death of Lincoln was a disaster for Christendom. And I'm still talking about Bismarck here. There was no man in the United States great enough to wear his boots. And Israel went anew to grab the riches of World War I. I fear the Jewish banks, with their craftiness and torturous tricks, will entirely control the exuberant riches of America and use it to systematically corrupt modern civilization. The Jew will not hesitate to plunge the whole of Christendom into wars and chaos in order that the earth should become the inheritance of Israel. Thus Bismarck, who knew the game of the Jews, spoke in 1876. According to Bismarck, the awful civil war in America was fomented by a Jewish conspiracy, and Abraham Lincoln, the hero and national saint of the United States, was killed by the same hidden hand which killed 6 Romanov czars, 10 kings, and scores of ministers, only to easier bleed their nations. Lincoln was re-inaugurated on March 4, 1865, and was shot on April 4, 1865, by actor Wilkes Booth, who cried, the South is revenged. He was a Jew, but this has never been mentioned. Major General Count Sheriff Sporadovich, the secret world government, or the hidden hand unveiled in history, 100 historical mysteries explained. The Anti-Bolshevist Publication Association, New York, 1926, pages 177 through 178, 180 through 81, and 183. Again, by an actor, Wilkes Booth, who cried, "The South is revenged." He was a Jew, but this has never been mentioned. 1881, President Garfield states 2 weeks before he is also assassinated by... Okay, 1881, President Garfield states 2 weeks before he is also assassinated by Jews, Charles J. Guiteau, G-U-I-T-E-A-U. "Whoever controls the volume of money in our country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize the entire system is very easily controlled one way or another by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate." The next two presidents to be murdered were also murdered by the Jews. William McKinley, the third American president to be assassinated, was murdered by a Jew called Leon, and I ain't going to try to pronounce it, C-Z-O-L-G-O-S-Z. And President Kennedy was also killed by jury for the same reasons. I'm not so sure about that. There's an investigation that has been done into this claim of that executive order. And Jim Mars was the instigator of the common urban myth that the executive order was intent to get rid of the Federal Reserve. It did not. And I will bring this up in a little bit more detail at a later point. The man who did the video series called Money Masters, Bill Still, did a brief video on YouTube that explains what he found when he investigated that executive order by Kennedy. And it was not what Jim Mars says it was. Okay. Congressman McFadden was, and President Jackson had two attempts on his life, and Lincoln was killed, etc. I may read Congressman McFadden's speech one day. They tried to kill him. Actually, I think they did. I believe he died of poisoning. And he was very outspoken against them. And this was in the 1930s. Let me clear my throat. Okay. Then in 1913, the Federal Reserve Central Bank is set up in America under orders of Jewish puppet President Woodrow Wilson. This act literally hands the American economy over to a handful of powerful Jewish banking families. Bring what President Garfield warned about to pass. The main Jewish names behind creating the system of control were the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Warburgs. The placement for this was carried out by Morgan, who used his position to publish lies that a powerful bank in New York was bankrupt, knowing it would cause mass panic and a chain reaction among the Gentile public, causing them to withdraw their monies, causing the banks to call in all loans, which forced the recipients of the loans to sell whatever they had from their properties on. Thus, a depression was generated by Jews. Early in 1907, the New York Times Annual Financial Review, published by the Jew Paul Warburg, a partner of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, first official reform plan entitled A Plan for a Modified Central Bank, in which he outlines remedies that he thought might avert panics. Early in 1907, Jew Jacob Schiff, the chief executive order officer, rather, of Jews, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, in a speech to New York Chamber of Commerce, warned that unless we have a central bank with adequate control of credit resources, this country is going to undergo the most severe and far-reaching money panic in history. The panic of 1907 hit full stride in October. The panic of 1907 and some of its lessons Annals of the American Academic of Political and Social Science, Volume 31, January through June, 1908. And I have some more information on the Depression as well. I have some actual quotes of what their intentions were to cause the Great Depression, the one that supposedly started at the crash on Wall Street in 1929. Okay, the Morgan Interestings. Okay, that doesn't make sense. The Morgan Interest took advantage to precipitate the panic of 1907, guiding it shrewdly as it progressed. And that quote is from Frederick Allen, Life magazine. This led to a congressional investigation headed by Aldrich that stated a central bank should be created to stop such an event from happening in the future. Note, Aldrich later married into the Rockefeller family. In 1910, the Jewish bankers held a secret meeting on a Morgan estate on Jekyll Island, where they drafted the blueprint and then handed it over to Aldrich, who brought it into Congress. Aldrich's investigation led to his plan in 1912 to bring central banking to the United States with promises of financial stability, expanded international roles, controlled by impartial experts, and no political meddling in finance. Aldrich asserted that a central bank had to be, contradictorily, decentralized somehow, or it would be attacked by local politicians and bankers, as had the first and second banks of the United States. The Aldrich plan was introduced in 62nd and 63rd Congress, 1912 and 1913, but never gained much traction, as the Democrats won in 1912 and won control of both houses in the Senate as well as the White House. This later became known as the Federal Reserve Act. When in 1913 Woodrow Wilson, who was put up and backed by the Jewish bankers, was elected president upon the promise to them in return for their financial support to sign the Federal Reserve Act into law. At the time, the act was frustrated in Congress from passing. The Jews moved days before Christmas of 1913, when the majority of congressmen were home with their families. The Federal Reserve Act was voted in, and Wilson, true to his treasonous word, made it law. The Aldrich plan is the Wall Street plan. It means another panic, if necessary, to intimidate the people. Aldrich, paid by the government to represent the people, proposes a plan for the trust instead. The Aldrich plan was a forerunner to that which spawned the Federal Reserve, and that was said by Congressman Lindbergh. And that was the famous aviator's father, not the famous aviator. Both Lindberghs were American patriots. A world banking system was being set up here, a superstate controlled by Jewish international bankers acting together to enslave the world for their own pleasure. The Fed, who has usurped the government. Now, I added the word Jewish in that last quote. But this quote came from Congressman Lewis McFadden upon the passage of the Federal Reserve Bill. And this next quote is from Lindbergh. It says, this, referring to the Federal Reserve Act, establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this bill, the invisible government of the monetary power will be legalized. The worst legislative crime of the age is perpetrated by this banking and currency bill. Again, Congressman Lindbergh. This act establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the president signs this bill, the invisible government by the monetary power will be legalized. The people may not know it immediately, but the day of reckoning is only a few years removed. The worst legislative crime of the ages is perpetrated by this banking bill. And that was stated by Congressman Lindbergh as well. The Federal Reserve System virtually controls the nation's monetary system, yet it is accountable to no one. It has no budget. It is subject to no audit, and no congressional committee knows of or can truly supervise its operations. That was stated by Profession Murray Rothbard. I don't know what that means, profession. But anyway, that's an economist, a libertarian economist named Murray Rothbard. President Wilson also brought America into the first war for the Jews after being elected on the promise of keeping America out of the war. The other important reason the Jews wanted America in World War I was now in control of the American money supply via the Federal Reserve. They need America to enter into the war, which would require the American government to take massive war loans and hook them into debt to the Jewish banks faster and on a monolithic pace. As the Jewish defector who was later murdered by the Mossad, Benjamin Friedman, speaks, at the outbreak of World War I, the Fed was better positioned than the Treasury to issue war bonds, and so became the primary retailer for war bonds under the direction of the Treasury. After the war, the Fed, led by Paul Warburg and New York Governor Bank President Benjamin Strong, convinced Congress to modify its powers, giving it the ability to both create money as the 1913 Act intended and destroy money as the central bank could, from the confessions of one of the key Jewish swindlers involved at the time, says, I was a confidential man to the Jew, and I'm inserting the word Jew, Henry Morgenthau Sr., who was chairman of the Finance Committee, and I was liaison between him and Rollo Wells, the treasurer. So I sat in these meetings with the president, with President Wilson at the head of the table and all the others, and I heard them drum into President Wilson's brain the graduated income tax and what has become the Federal Reserve, and also indoctrinate him with the Zionist movement. Okay, I'm going to give my voice a little bit of break here. I haven't done this much reading in a while, and I will. I'm going to play a song, and I will be right back. Let's see here. Here's a good one.